From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On national TV last night, President Bush appealed to Americans to prepare for a long, expensive haul in Iraq and to the world to help. Through the United Nations, UN backers said it was about time, but neoconservatives in Washington are still arguing that the United States should handle Iraq itself. Tonight on Point, in the mean deserts of Iraq, is UN help a mirage? We begin in Nashville, Tennessee, where President Bush is taking a turn today from foreign affairs to promote his education initiative and raise funds for his 2004 re-election campaign. David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times and is traveling with the president. I asked him if the president's speech to the nation last night was indicative of a real mid-course correction in Iraq or not.
Well, we had a mid-course correction underway, Tom, before he spoke. The speech was just confirming what it is we all knew, and that correction, of course, was that he's got to go to the UN now and seek help from the people who he had initially angered when he went ahead and moved forward with the Iraq action despite the absence of a specific UN authorizing resolution back in April. But the correction is bigger than that because he's got different elements to this. One is how we pay for the military side of it. And let's face it, the military side of it is going to be a U.S. operation. As Secretary of State Powell said yesterday, we invaded it, we're the authority there, and at best he could get 10, 15, 20,000 additional international troops. Sounds like a lot, but when you consider it's taking 140,000 troops there now, it's not that big a difference. Then there's the question of who's paying for the reconstruction side. And there we really haven't heard very many specifics.
If the U.S. is still going to be in charge on the military side, and if it's not very clear how the reconstruction will be divvied up differently, where's the dramatic course correction?
Well, the dramatic course correction is who's going to be paying for all of this. And we do not yet know the answer to that. And the second question is how it is that the president is going to give the rest of the world something that they want in return for getting into this. And that may be in the authority that he has to pass along on the political side.
Isn't that the core issue? You've raised the question of whether this is a tactical change or a strategic change. If the United States is still asserting its unilateral right to intervene when and how it will in Iraq and elsewhere, will it win the cooperation of other nations, those who it has crossed swords with in the UN?
My view is that what the president is seeking to make this is just a tactical change, that he will change his rhetoric some, give up a little bit of political authority, but not make a major strategic change. It remains to be seen whether, in fact, the international community demands a strategic change. And I don't know necessarily that they will, because it may be well their view that they really want the lion's share of the burden here to remain with the United States.
Because then they don't have to chip in? Can Washington realistically look forward to major money coming from around the world?
I think they can look forward to some money coming from around the world, but I'm not sure major money. Look at it this way. We believe that it's probably going to cost $40, $50 billion the first year just in reconstruction. The president, in the announcement he made yesterday, put aside 15 to 20 for that, really closer to 15. So you've got to make up another $40 billion somehow. Even in the Gulf War, we saw the Japanese pay somewhere north of $15 billion when they were rich. They are not now in that position. Germany is likely to say that they gave it the opposite. They're paying for a lot in Afghanistan. I think you could see the European Union pitch in some, but by the time you take Germany, Japan, and the United States together, you've got half the world economy.
So, David Sanger, if there are not that many troops likely to come out of this, 20,000 perhaps tops, and if there's not a gusher of money coming, then why has an administration that's been so famously reluctant to share power in an effort like this, why has it stepped up and given these new signals?
Well, I think in part, Tom, because they have to make the argument that they are, in fact, doing this as an international operation. And one of the reasons they need to do that is to diminish our role as the sole target here, that they have to make the case that the whole world here is involved in taking charge of Iraq, and this is not just a U.S. versus the jihadis.
William Safire in the Times today is complaining about failure mongers. Are we now headed into a season where we're going to be handed very diametrically opposite or conflicting assessments of how things are going in Iraq, where we're going to be told on the one hand things are going fine, and on the other hand horribly?
I think we're already into that, and you saw the president himself yesterday in his speech say it's going fine in the north, it's going pretty well in the south, and our biggest problems are between Baghdad and Tikrit, the strongholds of Saddam Hussein. It's very difficult to get an overall picture. You know, you're in a country the size of California, and, you know, just because you have rioting going on in one city at any given time doesn't mean that elsewhere it isn't fine. And so it's a very hard thing to get your arms around. And I find, even as a, you know, reporter in Washington, getting various streams of information, I have a hard time putting it together.
David Singer, you're with the president today, this evening in Nashville. What's the sense inside the president's bubble today? Are people pleased with the effect of his speech last night, or are they feeling spooked?
Very mixed. I think there was some sense he did not deliver it with much verve. He started off very slowly, got a little better as he went into it. There was a sense, even among some of those who were very sympathetic to him, that he didn't go into enough detail about how this money would be spent, and of course, Congress is going to demand those details. So I think that at this point, it is far too early to tell whether this was a successful speech, but clearly they've got a political concern because his polls are dropping very quickly.
David Singer, thanks so much for joining us from Nashville.
Thank you, Tom.
David Singer is White House correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Nashville, Tennessee, where he's traveling today with the president. 4 days before the second anniversary of 9/11 and 4 months after the official end of major combat operations in Iraq, President Bush, in a speech to the nation last night, reasserted the U.S. commitment in Iraq and raised the need for more international help.
I recognize that not all our friends agreed with our decision to enforce the Security Council resolutions and remove Saddam Hussein from power. Yet we cannot let past differences interfere with present duties. Terrorists in Iraq have attacked representatives of the civilized world, and opposing them must be the cause of the civilized world. Members of the United Nations now have an opportunity and the responsibility to assume a broader role in assuring that Iraq becomes a free and democratic nation.
So, did you hear the president's speech last night? What role do you think the United Nations should play in Iraq? Do you believe that more international involvement will bail Washington out, or is that an illusion? Is this America's war to bear? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Ellen Lepson, president of the Henry L. Stimson Center. Good evening and welcome, Ellen Lepson.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Ellen Lepson, take us in here. The president said last night the United Nations member countries now have an opportunity and a responsibility to assume a broader role in Iraq. Do you think other UN member nations who may have opposed this war see it that way, as an opportunity and a responsibility?
Well, it doesn't look like a particularly attractive opportunity given how high the risk environment is in Iraq and given the recent bombing that was where UN employees themselves were targeted. So I can't say people would be approaching this with great enthusiasm, but they may be approaching it with some sense of moral vindication, because it was, I think, the general view of the international community that this should have been a shared project right from the beginning. But the United States, you know, pursued a policy that was largely unilateral, with some, quite formal consultation with the UN, but not a consultation in spirit, not a consultation that really included a genuine give and take about authorities and responsibilities, et cetera. So I think the UN community, first of all, is already taking some of that responsibility. They have been on the ground in Iraq doing humanitarian work and doing reconstruction. Now the question is whether they can pick up more of the burden for both security, which the U.S. alone seems to be having a hard time managing, and also for the larger and perhaps more critical questions of governance.
But Ellen, if I may, what really caught our eye over the past few days was a couple of essays in the Weekly Standard, conservative, not to say neoconservative publication out of Washington in your backyard there, where the editors are saying that this is all wrong, that George Bush is, they said, desperation breeds illusions, and that the idea that the U.N. is going to bail Washington out of this conflict is an illusion bred of desperation, that the bombings in Najaf and Baghdad have convulsed, to use their word, the White House and the Pentagon, have got them in a panic. They're now turning to the U.N. They're trying to shrug this burden off, but that this isn't the kind of conflict, in their view, that can be effectively addressed by a few thousand more U.N. forces, and it's a sign of the United States not being ready to stand up and carry through on its own war. What do you say?
Well, I do think it's fair to say that the way and the timing in which the administration is suddenly turning to the U.N. is a bit unseemly. It does look like we're turning to them out of weakness, not based on the principle that they should have been involved right from the beginning. So it, in terms of style and impression, I think there's some merit to the argument that this is, shouldn't have been the way to do it. But one, the counterargument is that we should have gone to the U.N. sooner, or we should have turned to the U.N. in a more robust and serious way right from the beginning. The U.N. does have capacity to do some of this post-conflict nation-building, reconstruction, et cetera. I do think the security piece, however, there's probably more or less a consensus between the United States and the U.N. community that for the security piece, best if the U.S. military be clearly in a leadership position, but that supporting troops can come from places other than the United States.
Jack Beatty, a fascinating fandango unfolding here where you've got the neocons now throwing stones at the White House and saying, come on, don't lose your spine, don't lose your backbone now. Really saying not that they've gone to the U.N. too late or we should have gone earlier, but saying we're right not to go in the first place. We shouldn't go now. It will just confuse the issue. And it's a sign that Washington wants to lay down the burden that it chose so recently to pick up.
Yeah, there isn't a one of them who's ever run for public office. You know, the president, all the Democrats are saying he's got to do this. People in Congress all came back and with one voice, even Republicans said he has to do this. So even if he strikes out or even if he gets just a few people or just a little bit of money, he will have given himself a patina of legitimacy and he will try to remove a major campaign issue.
So you're saying it's about legitimacy, you're saying, not about material aid?
Well, I think it's about his political legitimacy. I mean, he's got to do this. This is something people, as I say, the whole political community is saying, you've got to go to the U.N. He goes to the U.N. You know, they're probably going to ask, they're probably going to raise the bar on what control means so high that they'll get little out of it. I mean, and let's unpack that notion of why we don't want to control. What is it we're afraid of giving up? Well, you know, clearly the contract's a part of this. I mean, Halliburton and the rest of them just would have to share the swag.
All the hundreds of millions in reconstruction contracts.
But at the center of it, let's face it, are the Shiites. I mean, in a fair election, they control the country. And, you know, it's been our aim for 20 years not to have a Shiite state next to Iran, the radical Shiite state of Iran.
So what are you saying, that the French, the Germans, the Chinese, the Russians do want a radical Shiite state?
Well, I'm just saying that if you get the U.N. in there, they're going to say we have to have this be a fair election. And our people have just woke up the day after the invasion and said, my God, George, we just knocked over a secular regime. They're right. And the Shiites may take control. We want to rig that constitution somehow and manipulate those political wires somehow to marginalize or contain the Shiite threat.
Ellen Lipson, do you think that's what this is about? Washington feels like it needs material help, but waffling on real democracy there because Shiites would just take over?
Well, I think they were always divided within the Bush administration on how important and how realistic the democracy piece of this initiative ever was. But I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, Shia majority rule will necessarily look like Iran. I think you've got secular Shia. There's a fair amount of political diversity and pluralism among the Shia community. Look, I think what the Bush administration has been confronted with is the sober reality that it's extremely hard to just pop in one day, take over a country, and think they're all going to fashion themselves according to some external idea of what politics should look like.
Or even lay down their arms. But is the UN the thing to solve this? We're looking tonight at the new U.S. outreach to the United Nations and the difference it may make in Iraq. Is UN involvement the answer to U.S. troubles in Iraq, or is it a mirage, an illusion? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at the new U.S. outreach to the United Nations and the difference it may make in Iraq. You can join this conversation. Is turning to the U.N. good sense? Is it wishful thinking? Is it desperation? Do you expect big troop numbers or big dollars from U.N. allies to help in Iraq? And if the United States can't succeed in Iraq without the United Nations, can it succeed with the U.N.? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Last night, President Bush addressed the nation about the crisis in Iraq, emphasizing the growing need for foreign troops on the ground.
Some countries have requested an explicit authorization of the United Nations Security Council before committing troops to Iraq. I have directed Secretary of State Colin Powell to introduce a new Security Council resolution, which would authorize the creation of a multinational force in Iraq to be led by America.
Led by America, multinational, will it work? My guest tonight, Ellen Lapson, president of the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. And joining us now from Washington, Frank Gaffney, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy. Good evening and welcome, Frank Gaffney.
Good evening.
Frank, we have seen this week neoconservatives Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan in the Weekly Standard saying desperation breeds illusion, and that the idea that the U.N. troops or even money, as whatever they may be, are going to come in and bail Washington out in Iraq is that illusion. What do you think? Is this new U.N. initiative a path toward success or just a refusal to pick up, sort of bear the cross of this war fully?
I think it's probably a legitimate aspiration on the part of the president to see if the minimum requirements of a number of allied countries or UN member states, at least, who have expressed a willingness, as you said a moment ago, to send troops, provided there is a UN mandate, will do so on terms acceptable to us. And I happen to think that is unlikely, personally, based on past experience, and may, frankly, wind up making it more difficult for us to accomplish the mission we've set for ourselves rather than ease that task with potentially very serious repercussions, not only for our interests, but also for those of the Iraqi people and the region.
Well, take us into that, Frank Gaffney. First, what do you expect the United States might get out of a new resolution if it can be passed? We heard David Sanger of the New York Times saying at the top of the hour, the expectation is not more than 10, 15, 20,000 more troops at the outside and not many more dollars in billions out of all that need to be spent. If everything goes swimmingly for Colin Powell at the UN, if it should go through on Washington's terms, what's the best they can hope for?
Well, that sounds about it, and minimal political interference, which is another wild card. That is, I think an unlikely outcome. We may find fewer troops, still fewer dollars, and insistence on far greater political authority and control than is acceptable or should be acceptable to the United States, for the simple reason, Tom, that the countries that are now demanding political control, or at least a direct ability to exercise influence over the internal affairs of Iraq as the price for whatever help they may be willing to tender, are countries that wanted to see Saddam Hussein remain in power.
That in any case, opposed military intervention. So, Frank Gaffney, how do you interpret, then, President Bush's new reach out to the U.N.? Is this, as the Weekly Standard has it, desperation?
Well, it could be desperation. It could be an illusion. It could be, as I've indicated, a legitimate aspiration for some help on reasonable terms. Another possibility, which is perhaps the most troubling of all, is that it reflects determination on the part of the political handlers surrounding the president in the White House that we don't want any more wars between now and the end of this term, and we'd just as soon shuck off the ones we've got so as to clear the decks for a more domestically focused political campaign in the coming months. That is most troubling to me because I think one thing is sure. We may say, as I have it in a column coming out tomorrow in the Washington Times, no more war in 2004. But it's very unlikely that that we will, in fact, see no more war in 2004. We will, I believe, in the interval, see, as the president actually indicated in his remarks to the nation last night, the war brought back here to our streets and to our cities.
That is, more terrorism here. Ellen Lipson, how about this this intersection of politics and military strategy in Iraq and on the domestic front in the United States? What do you see unfolding here? Can you... Well, it sounds Pollyanna-ish, but I'll ask it anyway. Can you imagine that the approach to Iraq will be influenced by presidential politics? Can the president afford that? This isn't a joke in Iraq. It's a big, serious commitment of troops and money.
Right. Well, I think Frank is right that the people around the president are probably very anxious by the time campaign season begins to have something else to talk about. And not what looks like, at least to some people, to be a disappointing outcome in Iraq so far. Also, if there continue to be casualties of U.S. troops, I think there's going to be a great pressure within the administration to try to switch the story to something else. But let's also, the other dots that we have to connect is the president's ability to refocus on a domestic agenda is going to be very hard given the cost that we're now only now beginning to realize of what the full implementation of his Iraq policy may entail, that in the end this Iraq policy may be number one issue in the campaign next year because of the burden on the U.S. economy as well as the danger to Americans. But I think it's quite unlikely that the president will have the satisfaction of being able to say that he knows for sure that he won in Iraq. He can still say, I think it was the right thing to do, but how persuasive will that be when people are faced with the cost in both human and economic terms, and for sure in 2004, Iraq will not yet be a democracy.
Give us a little military analysis from Iraq. Let's say that on the outside, that let's say 20,000 troops from Turkey or India or other nations ultimately arrive in Iraq, and that enables 20,000 or some number thousands of U.S. troops to be pulled out of standing on street corners here and there in relatively calm areas of Iraq and focused on the Sunni triangle in central Iraq. Could that make a big difference, Ellen? Could it turn things around?
It reminds me a little bit of an Afghanistan analogy where we allowed the international forces in ISAF to come in and do Kabul and, you know, help ladies across the street and do the sort of civilian side of policing in a post-conflict environment, while the U.S. troops and the Brits and a few other select allies did the much harder fighting of tracking down the residual elements of the Taliban and al-Qaeda in the hinterland of Afghanistan. So one can imagine that kind of division of labor between what is essentially the civil affairs part of post-conflict security presence and the harder security piece.
But is it a shift that would make a difference if we're talking 10, 15, 20,000 additional foreign troops or not?
Well, can I get into this?
Frank, yes, please.
It seems to me that a lot depends on other considerations. Specifically, to what extent are Iraqis themselves enabled to provide security in their countryside, particularly in those areas, as you've indicated, that may be less the object of turmoil or foment by the Ba'athists or the Islamists or some combination of the two. A relatively small number of foreign troops in addition to those already present might make a larger difference in that case. It might also actually be unnecessary in that case.
You wouldn't need foreign troops, you're saying?
You may well not. And personally, and I think this is certainly where Don Rumsfeld comes out, it'd be preferable to see Iraqi personnel assuming these responsibilities rather than having some new foreign interloper put in when the UN is not necessarily all that more popular, much more popular than we are on the one hand, and where the UN does have a propensity, as we've seen in Kosovo and Bosnia particularly, when it starts assuming responsibilities for nation building or governance on an interim basis and so on, to have that interim period proved to be quite protracted. And that's not, I think, in any of our interests.
Well, but I think that we have to give credit to the UN for learning a lot from the lessons of the Balkans, and they're much faster at deploying police forces, and they've got, you know, the Brahimi report that identified ways in which UN peacekeeping could improve its performance that came out in the year 2000. We're now at the three-year mark, and my think tank is just doing an assessment of a report card of has UN peacekeeping actually improved qualitatively. And I think it has. At the same time, this business of, you know, freeing up American troops, for sure, one of the things we need to do in Iraq is start delivering services so that the Iraqi population can genuinely believe that they're better off now than they were under Saddam Hussein. And it's possible that some of the talent that's in the U.S. military, Army Corps of Engineers, some of the other activities that have been applied with great effect around the world in other places, could then be mobilized for a little bit better impact on the civilian quality of life in Iraq. Maybe that's something that could be done.
We are looking at the new U.S. outreach to the U.N. and the difference it might make in Iraq tonight. I want to turn to our callers. John's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Well, in short, this isn't going to work. It's an illusion. The U.N., when it has a tough security problem, has historically turned to the United States. And we're there already, and we can't pacify this situation because basically there's a large-scale opposition to the occupation. Unless people regard UN hats differently, and there's no reason to believe that they would, it's not going to solve the problem. The major security power the UN ever deploys is there, and we can't fix it.
So what do you take away from that, John? What's the lesson then? What's the implication?
The implication is that this is the worst voluntary action we've ever taken on. I mean, unnecessary mess to get ourselves into that we've ever gotten ourselves
but
into.
Practically everyone now, John, Republican, Democrat, in between, is saying the United States cannot walk away from this. It has to follow through. Does that mean the U.S. just has to dig down, build a bigger military, devote even more billions to the war?
I don't see any good route at all at this time. All paths at this point seem to be very bad. And the exit now, Saddam is still on the loose. There is no exit path now, and the U.N. is not going to solve the problem. It is a big mess.
But the Pentagon, we're told, would like to get out of there. John, thanks for calling. Jack Beatty, let me turn to you, if I may. John's got an interesting point here. When the chips are down, when things get really tough, the U.N. has traditionally turned to the U.S. The U.S. is already there.
It's already there, and I quite agree with him that we have made a voluntary blunder of a historic proportions. This was foreseen, foreseeable, and predicted. People who said Saddam could be contained said that Iraq would quickly become the 51st state, that it would be a drain on our treasury. Already, according to one analyst I've seen, it's $1,000 a head. According to William Nordstrom, the Yale economist, if this goes 5 years, we could be looking at $10,000 per American taxpayer for this thing, and say nothing about the cost in blood. So, we can't hide that fact. And getting a few Fijians or Turks or whatever in there isn't going to hide the fact that we have made ourselves targets. Now that is our strategy. Rumsfeld, Bush, Cheney, they all say, good, we're there now. Let them shoot at us and we can get them. As if a war of attrition is what American boys and young men should stand up for for these terrorists. You know, 2 weeks ago or a month ago, the Financial Times reported that 3,000 young men went missing from Saudi Arabia, believed many of them to cross the border to fight jihad against our forces, to kill our kids. And then at the end of the 3,000, there are going to be more and more. And Rumsfeld and this idea of a war of attrition on our blood, boy.
But Jack, no one wants a war of attrition
here.
Yes, Frank Gaffney.
Tom, I disagree. I think what is happening on the ground and what will continue to happen as American forces hopefully are able with additional assistance from either Iraqis or international forces, or perhaps American forces, or other members of this multinational coalition. The Brits are sending in some now, able to prosecute the attacks against the Islamists coming in from Saudi Arabia or the Baathists that are raising their heads, is in fact to confine the fighting increasingly to the areas of the country that have demonstrated the greatest remorse over Saddam's fall from power because they were the principal beneficiaries of his.
The Sunni minority that wasn't doesn't want to lose control.
While
there.
These other areas that are, by and large, very stable at the moment, continue to prosper and become increasingly sources of, I think, stability and opportunity for the Iraqi people. That's a different scenario than the defeatist one you're hearing. I think it actually bears a closer resemblance to the facts on the ground.
Well, and that whole split screen is getting a lot of language put on today. William Safire talking about failure mongering in Iraq and the merchants of dismay over circumstances there. On the other hand, we've seen this drumbeat of U.S. troops dying. We've seen this drumbeat of serious bombings in the past few weeks. Ellen Lipson, to the basic question here of whether or not there's even a chance that the United Nations Security Council can agree on terms under which the UN will even endorse, throw its mantle over this military intervention.
My guess is we're facing weeks, if not longer, of haggling among the members of the council. I think the Europeans are kind of enjoying watching what they see as the Bush administration's squirming or comeuppance here. Of course, I think that their publics also have a stake here. Countries like India and Turkey that were pretty on the verge of saying, yes, they will contribute troops, now may face some second thoughts when they see the security environment that those troops would go into. So countries that stayed out of this, didn't support the war, may now find it a little bit unpalatable to be expected to go in and clean up. I do think on the question of controls and authority, et cetera, it is possible to imagine a resolution that would minimally satisfy all the parties, where military control would remain in the hands of the United States until some new Iraqi government were fully sovereign, whereas the governance piece, the holding of the elections, the getting the Constitutional Assembly, you know, I should have said those in reverse order, would over time move over to the UN, which does have some experience in doing it. It raises the dilemma that you said before of what if the United States decides it's not so enthusiastic about a democracy in Iraq and would prefer a controlled environment, in which case then it's going to raise yet more anger in the international community that one more time the Bush administration has changed the rationale for why they did it in the first place.
So your bottom line bet here, will Colin Powell be successful in getting the Security Council to agree to something that Washington can also accept that has a chance of getting troops and money flowing from overseas?
I don't think Powell alone is going to be able to negotiate it. I think it is going to be the president's going to have to do some of the heavy lifting. I think it's possible that we'll get a resolution, but that still doesn't mean that new troops would be moving to Iraq for perhaps 4 to 6 months from now.
We've got a tough, tough situation here. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the new U.S. outreach to the United Nations and the difference it may make in Iraq. My guests, Ellen Lipson from the Henry Stimson Center and Frank Gaffney from the Center for Security Policy. You can join us as well. Will UN powers answer Washington's call for help? Should they? And is the Bush administration accepting a less unilateral view of the world or just reaching for more resources? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new U.S. outreach to the United Nations and the difference it may make in Iraq. My guest tonight, Ellen Lipson, president of the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington, and Frank Gaffney, president of the Center for Security Policy. You can join us as well. Are you confident that one way or another the U.S. will succeed in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Andrew's calling from Whitewater, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, my call. Very good guest, very good discourse. Unfortunately, I don't see how we are going to be able to get participation from the UN at this point, even with the very convincing argument of the president and Colin Powell. If they wouldn't go in from the beginning with all our great rhetoric, why would they come in now, especially under a situation that we want, which is maximum participation with minimum control?
And if they don't come in, Andrew, what do you think are the implications for the United States if the UN doesn't join the effort?
Very bad. Unfortunately, I think what we really have to gain is not having to send in our reserves and our National Guard troops for this peacekeeping operation. The ground commander there said a couple weeks ago, 1 year tours of duty, then we rotate out. We're quickly going to run out of active duty forces and we'll be forced to send in reserves and National Guard. And with the current security situation, I don't think Americans are going to sit very well with our college students, our bankers, our assistant grocery store managers getting killed while doing their weekend or their year-long duty as National Guard or reserves. I think it's very bad if we don't get some U.N. support.
Got it. Andrew, thanks for your call. Frank Gaffney, two things there, if I may put them to you. First of all, the word from Washington is that it is fundamentally in the interests of America's allies, however testy relations may have been lately, that the U.S. succeed in Iraq. And so they may balk and they may drag their heels, but ultimately they're going to feel a strategic, profound interest in pitching in. Do you buy that?
I think if they were motivated, as we are, by a fundamental sense that what is best for the people of Iraq and for that region and for the larger world's interests is a free, prosperous, stable, ideally democratic Iraq. Unfortunately, that's not the way quite a number of the countries that that have votes in the United Nations Security Council have viewed this.
But even if they're not so idealistic, they don't want a chaotic, terrorist haven, madhouse in Iraq, surely.
They have made clear in successive votes on the question and public postures and policies that they were quite content to have a brutally repressive government that was engaged in the amassing and use of weapons of mass destruction and wars against its neighbors remain in power indefinitely.
But that's gone now.
They wanted to do business with it. And the question is that we have to wrestle with is, will the terms and conditions that the United States gets reduced to, if in fact the president says, I'm going to get a UN resolution no matter what, the lowest common denominator turn out to be a return opportunity, if not a short route to a return, of some new despotic government that will, yes, offer them economic opportunities for profiteering or oil revenues or what have you, no matter what the cost.
But the costs here are so large. Ellen Lepson, let me turn to you on this. The costs are so large, might it not be that at some point even the United States would embrace a strongman ruler? We're talking about another $87 billion requested last night. If that continues to go on, the United States may well drop its sights shy of democracy as well. Some say that Donald Rumsfeld already has.
Well, I remember right from the beginning, we thought that there was at least one faction in the administration that was prepared to hand the baton fairly quickly to the Iraqi National Congress, the folks who had been Iraqi opposition in exile.
Amid Chalabi and that crew. Mm-hmm.
And there are some perhaps very fine individuals in that organization, but it certainly would not have guaranteed a transition to real democracy and representative government. It might have, but it was certainly not a guaranteed route to go that way. So I think we should not assume that the United States was always only thinking about truth and light and goodness and everybody else had craven mercantile interests. I think to the contrary, everybody in the international system, including the Bush administration, is balancing, consideration of the interests of the Iraqi people, the gross human rights and violence and aggressiveness that we associate with Saddam, and everybody's glad he's gone. And let's face it, oil and the stability of the flow of oil and some other immediate economic interests. I think it is unfair to suggest that other countries are only motivated by the economic, riches that Iraq represents and suggests that that's not part of the U.S. motivation.
Well, juggling a lot of interests here and in up to our neck, Lloyd's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Lloyd, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
My question is, it seems like we have a very Western analysis here in terms of what's good for Iraq and what would the Europeans say and what's the United Nations about.
Okay.
And my general question is, if the United Nations was involved, what would be the implications in terms of the attitude Saudi Arabia and Egypt, the neighboring countries within that geography?
It's a great question, Lloyd. Our time is short. Let me take it right there. Frank Gaffney, first to you. Might that gain Washington more support in the Middle East for the whole effort, the UN mantle?
Well, the countries that he's just mentioned, I think, are among those who would be very happy to see some new authoritarian system put into place.
But we're talking about UN involvement here in the first instance, and might that lead to fewer of those guys pouring in across the border from Saudi Arabia, as Jack had it earlier?
Well, I don't think so. I think that these are people who make no distinction between infidels who happen to be Americans and infidels who happen to be of some other nationality or ethnic background.
But through the UN, it could be, it could actually be Arabs. It could be
Muslims, Tom. Let's face it, these are people who, particularly the extremists of the Shia and Sunni stripe, are perfectly content to murder their fellow co-religionists. So this is not going to change the picture. It just is a question of, is the political as well as the military arrangement under which the remaining effort to consolidate the liberation of Iraq going to be hampered by this UN presence or involvement or diktat or enhanced? And I'm afraid it will be hampered considerably, if not undermined altogether.
Ellen Lipson, very quickly to you, if the UN mantle is thrown over this, does it make this the whole military engagement look more palatable to Arabs in the Middle East?
Well, I think on balance for incumbent governments, yes, it would make them feel a little bit less exposed to what is seen as a kind of, that, you know, publics are feeling a bit schizophrenic about the U.S. Presence and what the U.S. is up to. But let's be honest, a lot of Arabs do not support what the U.S. has done, not because it's about Saddam, but because it's about American power.
And there's a big equation with no easy answer tonight. Ellen Lipson, president of the Henry L. Stimson Center, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Frank Gaffney at the Center for Security Policy, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. Jack, stay with us for a moment. We're going to hear the Supreme Court hearing arguments on campaign finance laws. This is On Point. The Supreme Court broke early from its summer recess today to hear arguments on the constitutionality of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. The unusual four-hour session featured arguments over two main parts of the law, one that restricts so-called soft money contributions to political parties, and another that bans issue ads paid for by third parties in the weeks before an election. Solicitor General Ted Olson was among several lawyers defending the contribution limits prescribed in Title I of the McCain-Feingold law.
The issues the court considers today, every single one of them in connection with Title I, are not new. For a century, with the overwhelming support of the public, Congress has struggled to curb the corrupting influence of corporate, union, and large unregulated contributions in federal elections. Time and time again, this court has agreed that achievement of that goal is critical to avoid erosion of public confidence in representative government to a, and I'm using the court's words, to a disastrous extent.
General Olson, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. These laws abridge the freedom of speech. So how do you get around the very simple text of the First Amendment?
What Congress has done is read the decisions of this court from 1976, and including the earlier decisions, that said that specifically said and have said over and over again that the regulations of contributions, we're talking about contributions, not expenditures. This court has said the regulations of contributions to the federal election process by unions and by corporations may be controlled by Congress in federal legislation in connection with federal elections. This court has said that over and over again. And this court said in Buckley.
Right, that's plausible, I suppose, that a contribution to somebody else to speak whatever he wants is not your speech. But what do you do about expenditures? This law regulates a lot of expenditures.
This law, referring to Title I, makes certain contributions illegal to the federal, to the national parties, and to their conduits and surrogates. Contributions from unions, corporations, and in excess of certain limits. Of course it says that once it's said that the contribution is illegal, the solicitation of the contribution is comparably illegal.
Solicitor General Ted Olson being questioned there by Justice Scalia, arguing in favor of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. Later, Floyd Abrams, representing the National Association of Broadcasters, argued that the ban on issue ads paid for by third parties in the weeks leading up to an election contained in Title II of McCain-Feingold is unconstitutional. These ads do not specifically advocate voting for a particular candidate, but they are highly political in nature.
As we turn from Title I to Title II, we turn to efforts by Congress to limit, to regulate, and ultimately to punish what are only expenditures. Expenditures not made in coordination with parties or candidates, which would result in them being treated as contributions, but independently. And so we deal here with it this afternoon in an area which, as this court observed in Colorado too, it has routinely struck down any limitations in this area. We are all agreed here that strict scrutiny applies. There is no dispute about that. And I think we're all agreed that this is a content-based restriction on speech. Whether we're agreed or not, it is a content-based restriction on speech.
Why should a speech urging expressly to elect a particular candidate to the President of the United States, why should that speech be entitled to less constitutional protection than a speech urging the ratification of the Panama Canal Treaty, for example?
The only reason and the only justification is that that speech becomes, as it were, so much like a contribution, so much like a final act of saying, vote for the candidate, not for this reason, not by inference, not by suggestion, but that by finally giving an unambiguous statement.
It
that
should therefore get less constitutional protection. That's what you're saying, I think.
It was afforded that little sliver, and it was intended to be a sliver, as I read Buckley and MCFL, was afforded less constitutional protection.
Under your submission.
But with respect, that was your submission. I mean, that
you're saying the only reason is that Buckley said so, and so we'll stick to it.
No, I'm not saying it's the only reason. I am saying that a flat statement saying vote for somebody can be distinguished from how to vote on the Panama Canal.
Attorney Floyd Abrams arguing against the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law before the Supreme Court earlier today in an extraordinary four-hour session there. Jack Beatty, the First Amendment being argued here, and behind it a desperate desire to somehow do something about campaign financing in the U.S.
Yes, and the example that Abrams was using defending these issue ads, well, the Times on Sunday made a good point about that. They pointed out how phony these can be. For example, in Montana, a candidate accused another candidate of taking a swing at his wife, or an issue ad did, and the issue being supported family values. So it wasn't a political ad. It was about don't hit your wife, we're for family values. That's the kind of thin screen that these issue ads, you know, this is the last gasp, really, of process liberalism. If we can only get the process right, you look at McCain and Feingold, the two of them, if we can only get the rules right and limit money, everything is going to be fine. I mean, it's a makeshift. What we need, if we want to reclaim our politics, is public funding of elections.
Well, the outcome is certainly not clear in the Supreme Court. We'll be watching that as it unfolds. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. A special welcome tonight to our listeners at WEKU-FM in Richmond, Hazard, and Corbin, Kentucky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.